The world entirely is at war.
Troops waiting for the zero hour.
This is D-Day.
They got one.
Veterans Chronicles. For the next hour, join host Gene Pell and an honored roster of heroic soldiers, sailors, and fighting aviators, recalling and retelling their personal stories from World War II...
A state of war.
...to the present day.
Allied Air Forces began an attack on military targets in Iraq and Kuwait.
Now the American Veterans Center and the Radio America Network present Veterans Chronicles with your host, Gene Pell.
Welcome to Veterans Chronicles. I'm Gene Pell. My guest this week is retired Army Lieutenant General Harry Kennard, a graduate of West Point and a soldier with extensive and distinguished combat experience in both World War II and Vietnam. He parachuted into Normandy on D-Day and was later in Bastogne during the Battle of the Bulge as part of the 101st Airborne Division. During the Vietnam War, he commanded the 1st Cavalry Division. Our conversation begins with events of December 1944, when the 101st found itself outmanned and outgunned by a superior German force at a place called Bastogne.
General Kennard, take you back to December of 1944 to begin. You are in some of the worst weather that Europe had seen for a very long time. You're in a place surrounded by a very powerful German army force. You've just come out of 70 days of very tough and difficult fighting behind the enemy lines in Holland. Your people are pretty much worn out. They don't have the proper clothing. They don't have the right weaponry or the right ammunition. And you're starting to run out of food, as a matter of fact, and the skies are not cooperating. You can't get an airdrop.
It's not just food either. We're very short of artillery ammunition, and particularly medical personnel and medical equipment.
And even some of the medical equipment you had just been run over and taken by the Germany to your field hospital.
That's correct. Our whole regimental company had been captured because they went to a place that would have normally been safe. But when you're surrounded, there isn't any safe place, you know, for the people that are outside the circle.
So how did you survive?
Well, it was a combination of things. I've asked myself that question a lot of times. I think the biggest single factor was the quality of the troops that we had in the Airborne Division, 101st. They were wonderful men, and you really had to rein them in rather than kick them in the pants. I mean, they were gung-ho, first degree all the time. You know, you constantly had to tell them, take it easy, and that kind of thing. And that's the kind of people I wanted to be with, but at the same time, it's tricky to command them. But I think in addition to that was the fact that we had a lot of artillery there, much more than we would have had as a division. And also, our artillery was very light. Our divisional artillery was the PAC-75, which is a very light piece of equipment, a nice piece of equipment designed and invented by the French in World War I. But it only had a range of about 6,000 meters, which was nothing. And our other artillery was the Cannon Company 105, which was just a short tube thing, and it had only a very short range of about 6,500 meters. So what saved our bacon was primarily the fact that we had the artillery of the CCB of the 10th Armored Division as their artillery. They had 155s, motorized, armored and all that sort of thing. And then Colonel Roberts had been in World War I. He was the commander of the CCB of the 10th. And he remembered that there were a lot of stragglers a lot of times, and he reckoned that there would be stragglers in this operation you're talking about. And he made a point to ask General Middleton if he could stop any stragglers coming through Bastogne and use them as he saw fit. And General Middleton agreed to that and even gave him a written order to that effect. So he stopped not only individual stragglers, but also stopped full battalions of 155s that had their ammunition trains with them and everything, and they were wonderful because General McAuliffe, our acting division commander, was himself an artilleryman, and he had a wonderful subordinate named Tommy Sherburn, who actually was the acting artillery commander because McAuliffe was the acting division commander. And we knew how to use these things, and our size was such that we could fire almost every gun we had at almost any place around the perimeter that the enemy attacked. And that's a lot of artillery. I mean, we just knocked the pants off their tanks and everything else with artillery. We knocked a lot of them out with other tanks and with the tank destroyer.
Now, you were the G3 on the staff of General McAuliffe. How much actual intelligence did you have about the strength of the Germans and the situation you were actually in?
Actually, at the time we arrived, we had none, of course. And I don't know if you knew this, but our advance party had been given the wrong directions. What we ourselves told was the place to go, which is around the left side of the bulge from Morbihan. And so they left early, and that was our directive at the time they left, was to go around the left side to where the 82nd finally fought in the bulge. But when we got to a road junction where the road split, one went where we were ordered to go and the other went to Bastogne, General McAuliffe just intuitively said, you know, I think we could pop over to Bastogne. It's just a mile or two away here, and get a little gin on this thing, figure out what's going on. So I said, great idea. I was riding with him in a sedan going up there. And so we went there, and Middleton was about the only guy in the CP that was kind of calm, cool, and collected. They looked like a bunch of rats when the cat came in or something, but they were all busy bugging out. But they told us what they knew about it, which was still not a lot, but they guessed that the Germans were pretty darn close. And so anyway, that massing of artillery was a very important factor.
But you didn't have any real knowledge as to the size of the enemy force, did you?
We did not, and even after we got after the fight began, the real good information that we got was our tactical information. When we captured somebody and identified him, we captured Germans from seven different divisions, four panzer divisions, armored divisions, two infantry divisions, and one parachute division. I'm not saying that all seven of them were fighting all the time or anything like that. In fact, we have no way of telling exactly what some of the attacks were about, which units. But it's still a lot of Germans, however you slice it. And in addition to a thing that worked for us all the time was the snow and the cold. It was bad for us, but it was worse for them attacking through it. I mean, it was tough going. The Ardennes, you know, is always bitterly cold in the winter, and this particular winter was the coldest it had in 50 years. And, man, that's cold. And the snow, when it came, was about up to your chest. A guy would be walking, fighting in the woods. He'd get hit, not too badly, but he'd fall in the snow, and if you didn't see where he went down, he'd freeze to death. I mean, that was...
As I recall, something like 25, 30 degrees below zero Fahrenheit?
I don't know what the exact temperature was. It probably did get at least to 30 below, I would think, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Very cold, terribly cold. But another thing that we had going for us was the tank destroyer battalion, the 705th Tank Destroyer Battalion under a guy named Templeton. They were given the order to get to Bastogne, and the saga of how they got there is a story in itself. I don't know it in detail, but they had to fight and bypass and do everything you can think of to finally get through to us. But they were a good unit, and they had the very latest gun, a really hot 76 millimeter that would even take out the Tiger Royal. And that was the only things that we had there that would do that. I mean, Roberts had, they still had the old 75s in their tanks, and you could bounce those off a Tiger all day long, and you might have an earache, but that'd be about it.
A lot of historians think that Bastogne was one of the key turning points of the war, if for no other reason that had it not been held, and there had been a breakthrough by the Germans to Antwerp, for example, and they divided the American and British armies, mm-hmm. that war could have gone on a very long time. And as General Patton was once quoted as saying, that he still was among those few who believed the war could still be lost.
Yeah. I personally think Eisenhower made a very serious mistake when he let it be known that he was taking anybody's bet that the war would be over by Christmas. He was voicing that to a lot of different people, and a lot of us believed that might be the case, but there were all kinds of things that resulted from the fact all of our replacements that we got in, or almost all of them, were people that shouldn't have had to fight like infantry. They didn't know what they were doing, and it was because they turned the spigots down prematurely.
Were you aware at the time of how significant the place you were would turn out to be?
We thought it was very important because it was what the Germans called a road octopus. It was the most important road center and railroad center in the whole Ardennes by a long way. And we knew that they would be hard pressed to get any kind of a fight going if they didn't have that town.
We're talking with retired Lieutenant General Harry Kennard, and we'll continue our conversation after these messages.
Veterans Chronicles is presented by the American Veterans Center, an educational foundation dedicated toward preserving the legacy of America's servicemen and servicewomen of all generations. This center is home to two organizations, the World War II Veterans Committee and the National Vietnam Veterans Committee, each working to tell the stories of their respective veterans. In addition to this program, the American Veterans Center is also the primary sponsor of the National Memorial Day Parade, held annually in Washington, D.C. For more information on the American Veterans Center and its programs, visit the center's website at www.americanveteranscenter.org or call 703-302-1012, 703-302-1012. The American Veterans Center, 703-302-1012.
Listening to Veterans Chronicles, presented by the American Veterans Center and the Radio America Network.
Welcome back to Veterans Chronicles. This week, retired Lieutenant General Harry Kennard is sharing his experiences during World War II with us. So it's getting close to Christmas 1944. You're surrounded by a very large German force, and in fact, they have the, as it turns out, audacity, impertinence, to send a party forward and demand that you surrender. Tell us about that.
Well, it's become quite well known, but on the 20th of December, I've forgotten the exact time, but it was like 10 o'clock in the morning, four Germans, two officers, one the commander being a major, the other was a captain, I believe, I'm not sure, but two officers and two enlisted men of the German Army, under a white flag, came into our glider regiment. You know, we had three parachute and one glider division, regiment in the division. And they said, "We're parliamentaires, and we have a ultimatum here." So the enlisted men were kept at the platoon where they went in. The officers were blindfolded and led back to the next level of command, the company command post. And then the call went in over wire, as I remember, not radio, that they had this demand for our surrender. We said, bring it in. So they brought the thing in. They showed it to me and the G2 at the same time. I mistakenly thought that there was some Germans wanting to surrender to us, and this is quite the opposite. So we decided we had to take it into General McAuliffe, and we got the Chief of Staff, Acting Chief of Staff, took the thing in, said, General McAuliffe, we have a surrender ultimatum. And he thought it was some Germans wanting to surrender to us, same as I did. And we said, oh, no, they're telling us to surrender. He said, us surrender? Oh, nuts. Just, perish the thought sort of comment. And he then said, gosh, I don't know what to tell them. I spoke up and said, well, what you first said would be hard to beat. He said, what do you mean? What did I say? I said, you said nuts. And all the guys in the staff wagged their heads in an enthusiastic agreement. And so he sat down and very quickly wrote to the German commander, nuts, exclamation. The American commander gave it to Bud Harper, said, Bud, will you deliver this? He said, I'll be delighted. It'd be fun. So Bud Harper took it back to the where the Germans were still blindfolded, and he said to the major, Major, I have your answer. I'll put it in your hand. He puts it in his hand. The major says, is it affirmative or negative? He says, it's decidedly negative. It's nuts. And the German said, nice, nice, was ist das? He was totally nonplussed by what this could be. And he said, well, it's decidedly not affirmative. He said, it means the same as go to hell. And he said, I'll tell you another thing. He said, if you persist in your attacks, we'll kill every German in your unit. And the German said, we too will kill many Americans. That is war. Mm-hmm. And with that, they boogered off into the night. And to some extent, they carried forth what they said was going to happen. They said a lot of bad things were going to happen, to include Luftwaffe bombing and artillery. And that night, we got really a lot of bombs dropped by the Luftwaffe, one of which landed right on a medical collecting point. And we had about between 20 and 30 wounded who were killed by that. And we had one Belgian lady nurse who was a wonderful woman, and she was killed too by this bomb that went right into the aid station. Mm-hmm. And we got a lot of artillery, and a good friend of mine that I'd fenced with at West Point, Barry Brown, was killed in the bomb went through the hospital where he was wounded and in the hospital. He was, at that time, Barry Brown was a lieutenant colonel, and he was running the artillery for CCB of the 10th Armored at the time.
Tell me quickly about what it was like on, was it Christmas morning when you woke up and the skies were clear for the first time in weeks?
Yes, it was. We were running extremely low of artillery ammunition, and that was bad news because, as I said, the artillery was our boon. It was the real thing. And the weather was such that we couldn't get airdrop at first. But when the air finally cleared on the 22nd, I believe I could check that.
I have the date.
When the air finally cleared, the fighter bombers came in big time. And they really had a turkey shoot because the snow was such that they could see where the tanks had gone into woods and so forth by looking at the tracks in the snow. And they killed a lot of German tanks and a lot of German people.
My guest this week is retired Army Lieutenant General Harry Kennard, a graduate of West Point and a soldier with extensive and distinguished combat experience in both World War II and Vietnam. When we return, General Kennard will be here to talk about his experiences in Vietnam.
This is Jim Roberts, President of the American Veterans Center. I hope you are enjoying this episode of Veterans Chronicle. This program and all our programs are fully devoted to spotlighting America's military heroes from World War II through Iraq and Afghanistan. All of these programs are completely sponsored through the charitable donations of individuals like you. If you share our belief that America's men and women in uniform deserve to have their stories of valor told, contribute to our mission by calling 571-480-4152 or by visiting AmericanVeteransCenter.org. Thank you for your support and enjoy the rest of the show.
Heavy fighting is still raging.
3,639 wounded.
Red light, green light, and out, out. Get out.
Gentlemen, this is the real thing.
The brutal death march of Bataan.
Germany calling. Germany calling.
Right in the Fuhrer's face.
We'll have the ammunition and we'll
cheer for Harlem on parade.
You're listening to Veterans Chronicles, presented by the American Veterans Center and the Radio America Network.
In July 1965, then Major General Harry Kennard took command of the 1st Cavalry Division, and 1 month later deployed to South Vietnam with his soldiers. He's my guest this week on Veterans Chronicles here in the Washington studio of Radio America.
The climate was quite a lot different for you in the jungles and rice paddies of Southeast Asia, and particularly at a place called Le Drang. By this time, you were a commander of the 1st Cavalry Division, and it was a pretty bloody fight, wasn't it?
Yes, it was, and I've often thought about the same difference that you just described, the entire complete difference between the weather and the terrain and everything else in Germany vis-a-vis Vietnam. We were in the highlands of Vietnam, of course, and I'd like to back up just a little bit about the 1st Cav, because the Army had not done as well in movement as they had in firepower. And this was recognized by a lot of people, including McNamara. And McNamara had directed the Army to take a hard look at improving our mobility by increased use of aircraft, primarily helicopters, but all aircraft. And at the time, I was the assistant division commander of the 101 down at Fort Campbell. And I got a phone call that the chief of staff of the Army wanted to see me in Washington the next day. Well, that's a little rare for a brigadier general to be called up by the chief of staff, but anyway, I was up there, and he said, Harry, we're going to find out how fast and how quickly the Army can embrace air mobility, how quickly and how completely, and you're going to be the guy. Yes, sir. He said, it's very important. I'm going to let you have your pick of personnel to a large extent, which was wonderful and unusual, and so I went out walking on cloud nine, and but it was a tough thing. We had to for 2.5 years we tested everything. It was called the 11th Air Assault Division. I was the commander of it, and we tested everything that you could think of, to include even atomic war, but starting at guerrilla warfare and building right up through the spectrum to include atomic war. So there was a real question about whether the Army was going to approve this thing. At the end of the test of the 11th Air Assault Division, we fought the 82nd in a big maneuver in the Carolinas, and we whipped the socks off them, frankly, and some very bad weather there, too, and so forth. But anyway, the word went through the Army staff, they're good, and this is what we ought to do. And I put it in the paper, and I said, I think we should be called the 101st Air Assault Division. And General Johnston was the chief of staff of the Army. He'd been in the 1st Cav. He said, no, we're going to call it the 1st Cavalry Air Mobile. Yes, sir. But I ask also that all of the, except the aviation elements of the division, be airborne. I thought they should be jumpers. I believe that it does something. My father had always told me, and he was in the Army, my father had always told me that it's very difficult to tell in advance whether a man will be a coward or a hero in combat. It's just very hard to tell. But I thought that if a guy would jump out of a perfectly good airplane, there might be a better chance that he'd be that way. So I thought the world of it, and the airborne soldiers were great. So anyway, the chief of staff came down for sort of a graduation thing and said, you know, you've made it now, and we're going to be sending you to Vietnam. And he said, General President Lyndon Johnson is going to go on TV on such and such a date, and he's going to announce a state of emergency. Well, why is that so important? It's important because without a state of emergency, any soldier can get out when his time is up, if he served his time. Well, I had a lot of soldiers who only had months to stay or that kind of thing. As it turned out, Lyndon Johnson changed his mind between the day that the chief of staff came to see me and the day he made his talk. He didn't announce it. And I consequently lost thousands of people out of my division just before going to combat, which is not exactly the way you like it.
Well, this brings up another point, and I think an important difference between the two wars in which you've so played such a prominent role. In World War II, the entire country was behind the effort from beginning to end. The terms were unconditional surrender.
Mm-hmm.
And Roosevelt, my reading of history, pretty left things to George Marshall and his generals and admirals to run. Now you come to Vietnam, and you got decision-making taking place on the smallest level of detail in the White House, in the Pentagon, et cetera, et cetera. And a lot of people in high places, in high office, who had no experience whatsoever of the military.
It was a miserable situation, actually. I've thought about this forever. And in fact, I'll tell you that I got out of the Army because I was so upset at the way our people were being treated when they came back from Vietnam. That was the primary reason, really, that I got out. But you hit the nail right on the head. I mean, we thought we could do this thing slick and quick, and McNamara wanted to put sensors out all over the jungle, and there you got animals and wind blowing, and you're not getting real good information at all. But he thought that he could control it almost down to the squad level. I mean, it was pathetic.
Do you see any reflections of that in the current situation in Iraq?
There is. Fortunately, they haven't gone nearly as far this time, but I have some reservations myself about it because I think that it's important to have unit history, unit morale, unit esprit, and you don't get it by breaking up the division that we've had for a long time, that sort of thing, nor do I think it's necessary. I think that so I don't fully agree, but I understand why they're doing it.
Now, third important division I would like for you to talk a little bit about is, we've talked about the differences between the weather, the difference between political interference in these wars. Now, tell me a little bit about the differences in terms of fighting a set-piece army and engaging in a campaign against local insurgencies.
Well, I guess the biggest difference was that there were several very important differences. For example, no air threat from the Vietnamese, which made it an entirely different war. Well, I sent an advance party over there under General Jack Wright, who was one of my assistant division commanders, and he laid out a thing that looked for all the world like a target, like a donut. That was going to be our division thing. And I thought, this guy's lost his buttons. But then I got, no, there isn't an air threat. So there, it's okay. It's tight. We can defend it easily and have the max to go out and fight. So I had a meeting with General Westmoreland when I first went over there. And Westy didn't know what had been going on about the air assault testing and all that sort of thing. In addition to the fact that there was no air threat from the Viet Cong, the biggest problem really was finding them. And Germany, you didn't have the least trouble finding the Germans, I'll tell you. They were there, mm-hmm. big time. So the trick in Vietnam was primarily a hunting operation to find these people.
Mm-hmm. Did Westmoreland know about this special mobile air support that he was about to get?
He knew very little about it, unfortunately. And I said, Westy, I have a structure, a divisional structure, that requires that we be concentrated as a division, because otherwise there's not enough aviation to split it up into penny packets and send it all around. Well, fortunately, I was also able to tell him that the chief of staff of the Army had told me that my principal job was to keep the Viet Cong from cutting the country in two on the line Quy Nhon-Pleiku, which had been a real battleground in earlier wars with the French and so forth. So...
Well, tell me how it worked in actual practice, as opposed to all the training you had done.
It worked even better than I had expected it to work. It was incredible. There were a lot of problems that had to be solved. We flew basically what we call nap of the earth. And by nap of the earth, we meant you got a lot of tree leaves in your helicopters as they were getting there. I mean, you were right on the deck, and you flew under power lines. You didn't fly over them, under power lines, and you just stayed right on the ground. And I'll tell you, there would be a lot less geese killed if they were flying that way and were shooting back. So by not shooting back and flying nap of the earth, we were much less vulnerable than we would have otherwise been. But there were a lot of real tough problems, like communicating with aircraft that are flying low level and are 75 miles from where you are, because we had a tremendous operational area, my division did. Mm-hmm. We were 100 miles from the Quy Nhon on the ocean back to the border with Cambodia and Laos. And about to almost 100 miles in the other direction. No division in the world ever had a chunk of territory like that. And we were actually able to do quite a good job in the whole thing. And then later on, of course, other divisions came in there. But anyway, no air threat. You have to hunt for these guys. You have to solve a lot of problems of communication with low-flying aircraft. But once you do all that, it's just incredible how much difference it makes if you have somebody that can't be interdicted on the ground as they move.
Well, surely one of your biggest problems of all was what I would call the issue of sanctuary, because the rules of engagement did not allow for pursuit across the border.
And incidentally, in the big fight that we had that was written up as war, we were soldiers once, by Galloway and Hal Moore.
Well, they talk about the fact that the enemy was able to pick and choose when he wanted to fight and disappear when he wanted to disappear, and yeah. He was in physically located where his supply lines were at their shortest and most convenient.
Actually, Hal Moore was representative of the way we fought that thing. When we were first there, and Westy, as I say, didn't know about our capabilities and limitations. he would typically send us into some area and say, I want you to go in there and fight for 48 hours. I mean, that's a strange kind of mission. It didn't mean a thing to me. And I kept saying, why don't you tell me to develop a situation? I'll go any place that you think is hot, but I want you to give me the latitude to develop the situation and then fight it. Finally, when there was the attack on the Arvin camp outside of Pleiku, I convinced Sweet Larson, who was a classmate of mine, the Corps commander, to tell Westy, give Kennard his head, let him go chase these guys out of there. So Westy said, okay, give Kennard his head. So I said, that's all I want to know. And we took out after these guys, and we chased them from Arvin camp all the way out to where Hal Moore had the big fight on X-ray and so forth. And at the end of that fight, the people left that he'd been fighting headed for the border. And I asked permission to cross the border with my division. I wanted to put them clear out of action. We were trying to pursue them as much as we could. You know, that's what you do. It was approved by Westy. It was approved by our ambassador over there, who was Lodge at the time. And I went back to the United States, disapproved. And I said right then, there's no way we can win this war if we're going to let this guy have a sanctuary. You know, that's it.
Our thanks to retired Army Lieutenant General Harry Kennard for sharing his experiences in World War II and Vietnam. That's it for this week's edition of Veterans Chronicles. I'm Gene Pell. Thanks for listening.
This has been Veterans Chronicles, produced by Radio America and the American Veterans Center in association with Pellcom Communications. Thank you, veterans, for your service to our country.
The great sea and air battle has been raging in the Solomon area since last Sunday.
From the Radio America Network.